Hello, it's Friday, January the 29th. This is The Daily Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom, and I'm Andrew Pearce. And coming up, we'll be talking about the Great British Bake Off, which has a genuine celebrity lineup, including a Hollywood A-lister. Stay tuned. Summer schools, should they be brought back to enable some of our children to have a catch-up on what they've lost in the last year? They're called influencers. No, I don't know why either. And they're stuck in Dubai, and they may be caught in the travel ban from the UAE. Do we care? But first, the tier system. Remember them? 1, 2, 3, 4. Did it even go to 5? They may not come back, which means when we come out of lockdown, it'll be all together for a change. So the Daily Mail is reporting today that the COVID tier system is to be scrapped, and that lockdown will be eased on a national basis instead. You remember, they were tiers of 4, 3, 2, 1, or did we even go to tier 5? It's hard to remember. Ministers are said to believe a national release from lockdown is more sustainable. But does that mean then the end of lockdown is delayed? And what impact will it have on British businesses, particularly the hospitality industry, which has been brought to its knees by this wretched pandemic? Joining me to discuss this is Kate Nichols, who is Chief Executive of UK Hospitality. Kate, I can see why they're doing this. We know there was a big bust up when parts of Manchester and the Northwest were in tier 4 and London was in tier 3 or tier 2, and politicians were saying the South was being treated more favourably than the North. It all got very difficult. So that's, I suspect, why the government is doing it, for political reasons. But what does that mean for your industry?
Well, I think for our industry, it's helpful to have a national exit from restrictions rather than going through regional tiers, partly because it makes it much easier to communicate to customers what they need to do. And we need to work quite carefully to make sure that we've got high levels of compliance with the controls that might still be in place. And we need a simplicity of message to make sure that customers are doing that. We know that we can do it successfully. We exited in a national way in July with COVID secure protocols across hospitality, and it worked and cases didn't spike. So actually that for our sector would be helpful. Secondly, it helps the operators because you can have very different trading conditions, very different economic impact if you are just a short distance away between one or two tiers. And so therefore, particularly for national operators, having one set of regulations to guide them by means that they can have a more profitable business. But it is quite challenging. All of the tiers that we had were reducing and suppressing our revenues to such a level that businesses weren't sustainable. And so that means the tier system isn't sustainable longer term, and we take longer to get back into recovery. So we think it will be good all round.
I can remember talking on this podcast to publicans who were literally 200 yards apart. One was under tier 4 restrictions and one was under tier 2. It seemed unfathomable that that's how it would operate. But of course, you have to have a cutoff point somewhere if you have the tier system.
Yes, and those cutoff points were the difference between business surviving and business failure. So, if you were in, sitting in London in tier 3 and not being able to do very much, but being able to be outside of London and have a greater ability to trade, when we had the situation where you had to have a table meal if you were going to go and have a drink in a bar, that meant it wasn't sustainable for those businesses. It was really confusing for consumers. And it was the difference between 20% of normal revenue levels and 50% of normal revenue levels just by traveling, maybe a mile apart. And for many of these businesses, you spoke about Manchester at the start, they've been in these kind of tiered restrictions since July, August last year. So we do need to find a way of exiting. And it's not just about the date we open, the conditions under which we open and the length of time we trade under those conditions are equally important to make sure that hospitality can get back to being full strength.
You talk about being full strength, but of course your industry is never going to be full strength again, is it? In the sense, Kate, that some of your members, I'm thinking about pubs and restaurants in particular, how many do you think are never going to reopen?
Well, we already know that last year, 10,000 pubs, bars, restaurants, hotels, guest houses closed their doors for good and won't reopen. So that's a contraction of a fifth. I suspect that it could be as high as a third if we don't get support to take us through the reopening phase of this. If reopening is delayed, if we're subject to restrictions for longer, then the industry estimates that it could be as high as a third of those businesses that we lose for good. Obviously, as we recover, I mean, I'm talking here about 2023-2024, you will see businesses start to re-emerge and you will see new openings. But if hospitality is helped and supported through business rate relief and VAT, then we can bring forward the economic recovery by 9 months and we can save those businesses from failing and save a million jobs.
If I could ask you as well, a million jobs you're talking about, the 10,000 the 10,000 businesses that have gone under, which we won't see again, very sadly, how many jobs do you think that represents, Kate?
Well, we know we've lost 660,000 jobs across hospitality since March last year, a huge human cost, and those are full redundancies and a complete reduction in headcount. We also know that those who've been, we've been fortunate to retain when they were working, when we were open, those sort of 3 months where we were trading without restrictions, people's hours were reduced by as much as two-thirds. So even those who are in the industry and have retained a job have done so at lower levels of pay. So we need to make sure that we can reopen hospitality in the right way with the right support, and then we can get back to generating jobs, securing the jobs of those who are still on furlough. There's still a million people in the industry on furlough. And making sure that we can contribute to our high streets and our communities and the cultural life of the nation going forward.
So just finally, do you think anybody's listening in government, in the Treasury?
I have to remain hopeful that they are. They've listened all the way through. They are continuing to have a dialogue with us. We understand that there is a challenge between balancing the needs of the economy and public health, and that we can't open too early, otherwise we will sadly, you know, see changes in the virus that could make it that we go back into more closures and lockdowns. But we do need to start prioritising economic recovery if we are to come out of this. And if we're moving from an epidemic, a pandemic, to an endemic situation with the virus, then we need to learn to live with it, and reopening the economy has to be part of that. So I'm confident that the Treasury is listening to that message and that we'll be able to move forward with the support we need.
All right, that's Kate Nichols. She's the Chief Executive of UK Hospitality. Thanks so much for joining us. So why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Daily Show for free and in full. Plus, there are other podcasts and videos you can watch too. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So children could be invited to do summer schools to help catch up on the months and months of missed education due to the relentless lockdowns. Sources in Whitehall are suggesting one model used by some London schools to offer half-day classes last summer could be deployed more widely. So how will that work? I'm joined now by Peter Lang, former secondary school head, who is an educational consultant. Mr. Lang, they've got to do something, surely, with these children. If there were to be summer schools, what age group do you think they should be primarily targeted at?
I think that the plan is, it's just part of a plan, much needed plan. I think it's to be welcomed. Obviously, the devil's going to be in the detail. And of course, people are saying, our Prime Minister said that young people are going to be behind it, missed a year. So the idea that this is going to suddenly allow some young people to catch up, I think we need to be very honest, that's not going to be the case, but it's going to be something. And I think if it's discussed at a local level, as it was in London with some schools last summer, I think that school leaders and others can put into place some quite good plans. It would be up to them, perhaps, to decide who are the priority students. There's a lot of evidence that this pandemic has disproportionately affected disadvantaged children. And of course, it has greatly. But all kids actually have been affected by the pandemic. You know, there's been rises in anorexia, eating disorders, mental health referrals gone up exponentially. So the idea of getting young people back to a structure, to learning, I think is a good one. But these are summer schools. They're not going to be crammers that are going to suddenly replace what's been missed.
It would be, of course, a great relief for the parents, too, to get the kids off their hands, and to, because I know some of the kids are very bored and getting fed up and there's all the sort of mental health issues. What will it say, though, about teachers, Mr. Lang? Because already I've read that some of the teaching unions are expressing misgivings about that, which is very disappointing if that's their going to be their stance in the beginning of the talks about this.
Well, I think we have to be a little bit careful about that, because although officially schools are closed, they have been operating since last March. I mean, drive past any school and you'll see cars in there. Teachers are going in, support staff are going in. Some schools have got between 30 and 50% of their pupils going in. And teachers are working. They are either working in the schools or they're working at home. There's big online provision being provided. And so I think it would... I think local leaders would work out who is going to operate these schemes. It wouldn't be just an extra burden upon the existing teachers. Some teachers might volunteer to want to do it, but then you could bring in other people. I'm not to say
retired teachers, maybe.
Well, you could do. I mean, you've got to be careful you're not bringing in a sort of dad's army of people.
Yes.
And the remit has to be what is what they're able to do. As I keep saying, we're not going to make up for all this lost learning, but we could put something in place. So I think models such as that, activities that could take place, you know, sporting activities, drama activities, outdoor art activities, all of those things are opportunities, I think, which could take place. So I think that head teachers would want to work with their staff and would want to work with their local unions and associations to come up with plans that would work. I'm sure that they could.
Do you think it's going to happen?
Well, I think it is. I mean, as I said earlier, I think the idea of a plan, we're only at the end of January, and so we're talking about planning for the future. And it does look like many schools won't be back in operation until the summer term. I mean, the figures are still very, very dire, aren't they? And we have to be careful about safety, and let's not kid ourselves that the vaccination is going to suddenly enable this. But it's part of a wider dialogue. I know some headteacher colleagues are saying to me that they feel that this is a positive in the sense that they feel as though they're being listened to now as part of a wider plan which can be put into place, you know, rather than just a knee-jerk reaction. So I think it will. I think it will happen in some form. But it needs to be locally decided upon and locally agreed upon for the benefit of everybody, most of all the young people.
Very good advice. That's Peter Lang, former secondary school head teacher and educational consultant. Thanks so much for joining us. If you enjoy The Daily Show, why don't you subscribe to us, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify, follow us at Mel Plus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. That's me. I'm at Tory Boy Pierce. Don't forget how to spell Pierce. P-I-E-R-C-E. Influencers, you know who they are, face being stranded in Dubai. How terrible. How will the nation cope? Because some of them have claimed to be essential workers, brightening the lives of those of us stuck at home in lockdown Britain. The trouble is, many of them are now facing a scramble to get home after ministers added United Arab Emirates to the so-called red list of countries from where travel to the UK is prohibited. Should we feel sympathy for them? Daily Mail columnist Jan Moyer thinks not, and she joins me now. Jan, I whooped with joy at your piece in your column today. But first, you must explain to listeners of this podcast, what is an influencer? Who do they influence?
Well, an influencer is one of these sort of modern phenomenons. And what I often think is, thank God I don't have children, in case one of them said to me, Mum, I want to grow up to be an influencer. I mean, there's sort of kids who, they look at people like the Kardashians, who are like this sort of royal family of influencers. They're the ones who started it all off on social media sites like Instagram and Twitter. And basically what they do is they pretend to be friends with all their followers. You know, all these kids who sort of tick the box and follow them online. They pretend to be friends with them, but they're really selling them things. You know, they're selling them makeup and watches and lifestyles or whatever. And the best ones can make a lot of money from it. But this gang who are out in Dubai, I mean, who are these people? Mia Sully from Absolutely Ascot, Love Island stars Joseph Garrett, OnlyFans model Honey Evans. I mean, I just don't know who they are, but they're out there and they're staying out there because they think the rules don't apply to them. But I kind of wonder, because a big part of being popular online is that, you know, these people have to be authentic and they have to be liked by their followers. But I'm not sure if they're not sort of fostering a lot of dislike and sort of, you know, because basically they're rubbing people's faces in it. They're saying, oh, you know, our lives are so much better than yours.
Yes.
You're stuck down in boring old England in lockdown, and here we are having fun in the sun. And, you know, that's not a very positive or happy message for everyone stuck at home.
How did they manage to get that? Because the new rules now, we've heard the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who got very cross to hear about people, as you rightly allude to in your column, turning up at airports with skis, hardly essential travel. How did these wretched people ever convince anybody that they really had to be in Dubai in the first place to spread their fabulous influence?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the whole thing about international travel at the moment is a complete mystery to me. I mean, indeed,
yes, it is.
Did anyone even stop them with their sort of, you know, bottles of fake tan and tattooed eyebrows and sort of tiny little thongs that, you know, and say, what are you doing? I mean, one of them claimed that she was a key worker and her job is to sort of cheer up people. You know, but I don't think anyone sort of buys that. But, you know, but what is going to happen to them? I mean, they might get stuck out there forever.
Oh, good. That's good, isn't it? Could we start another Daily Mail campaign? We're quite effective at campaigning, Jan.
Well,
what do you think?
Are. But the thing is, at least we know where they all are. And we can
yes.
avoid...
yes. But what has the UAE done to deserve these dreadful people?
What have they done to deserve them? Indeed. But I think they'll probably all be corralled in their sort of five-star hotels and basically not move from the pool side.
Yeah, but I suppose in the end, people would stop paying their bills. I'm never sure how these people earn the money in the first place.
Well, Andrew, you'd be amazed at how much money they can actually earn. I mean, I interviewed Georgia Toffolo recently, who's actually...
I know who she is, yeah.
Yeah, yes. She's a former Made in Chelsea star.
Yes. And, she's a friend of Stanley Johnson's, isn't she?
That's right. And someone like Georgia, who's got 1.5 million followers, she can actually earn a lot of money. It's her main source of income now. I mean, if she puts on a dress by Zara or something, they might pay her £200 to do that. She can get thousands of pounds per post. I mean, you know, they're monetizing their own lifestyles. They can earn a lot of money. I'm not so sure about this lot who's stuck out there, but
well, I think it's fabulous. I now know what an influencer is, and I didn't before, and I knew I should know, Jan, because I see the word bandied around. And is my life not complete though, Jan, in the sense that I've not been knowingly influenced by any of them?
Well, Andrew, I'm not being rude, but you're not really in the influencer age group.
That's pretty savage, Jan, actually.
You're beyond influencing. You're already where you want to be.
Right.
You know, and someone showing a picture of them with their post-workout smoothie or posing against a painted wall or all the kind of cliches that you do, it's not going to affect you because you know where you are in your life. And you
it's
know
true.
Where you're going. And but for sort of younger people who yearn after these maternal things and who really are sort of who think that Mia Sully from Absolutely Ascot is fabulous, you know, they're interested in what she does and what she paints her nails with and who she's going out with. But you wouldn't be.
No. And actually, Jan, I think if I had to toss up between it, either being locked down as I am in London or spending 3 months in Dubai, it's a no-brainer. I'd rather be in London, locked down.
But I wonder if these influencers, I think it just might be a step too far for these influencers because I think in the end they're going to end up making people fed up with them and not admiring them.
I couldn't agree more. I think I'm already fed up with them already and I've only talked about them for 5 minutes. That is the fabulous Jan Moy. Do read her column every Friday in the Daily Mail. It's always fabulous. And if you are one of those influencers and you're listening to this podcast, do get in touch. We'd love to talk to you. It's sport time. Matt Gatwood's here to help me with my sports education, which, as you know, is very limited. Matt, though, Liverpool United, all conquering last year. Have had an incredibly bad run for them. Has it come to an end?
Liverpool have, yes, got their first win since Christmas, yeah. So they finally, after that, they did their own sort of dry January, which wasn't one they chose to do. And they finally got back to winning ways last night, beating Tottenham 3-1 at Tottenham as well. So it was a very good result for them. I wouldn't say they were quite back to their brilliant best that saw them obviously win the league last year. But there were certainly signs that they were recovering some of their old mojo. They were good when they lost to Man U in the FA Cup at the weekend, and this was another sign that they're sort of heading back in the right direction. So they won 3-1, got some of their goal scorers back in scoring touch. So Firmino, their striker, scored, and Mane scored. So they'll be delighted to have got back to winning ways. Klopp was, having been fairly grumpy, Jurgen Klopp, over the last month, was beaming. Those big white teeth of his were out again. He was beaming at the end. So, yeah, very good result for them. But a pretty disappointing night for Tottenham, all in all.
And that's Mourinho, isn't it?
Yeah, that's Mourinho. And they lost Harry Kane to injury. He had to hobble off at half-time. He hurt both his ankles, apparently. So he looks like he might have done. We don't know the extent of the damage yet. It's still, his ankle is still so swollen, they can't do a scan on it today. So we won't know probably the extent of that till over the weekend. But it looks like it didn't look great. So it looks like he could be out for a few weeks. So that's obviously a massive blow to them, losing the England captain. They also, one of their players, fullback Serge Aurier, had a row with a fellow player at half-time, was then substituted and then stormed out of the stadium and didn't come back, didn't see the second half. So that's obviously not a good look. And how Jose Mourinho...
Matt, how many times do I keep telling you they're prima donnas, they're overpaid prima donnas? You defend them, well, but they are prima donnas.
I certainly wouldn't defend that sort of behaviour. And you're right. Well, and how Jose Mourinho responds to this, and whether Serge Aurier, the fullback, plays again for Tottenham, or how long he's left in the out in the cold for, remains to be seen. But I can only imagine Jose doesn't take kindly to that sort of thing. A pretty bad night for Tottenham all round, losing the game, losing their captain, and potentially losing their fullback for a while as well. Not a good night.
Just finally, Matt, on England cricket, they've got one of their star players is back.
Yeah, so Rory Burns, who missed the Sri Lanka series, and actually missed the South Africa series before that, but for two different reasons. He missed South Africa through injury. You'll remember he turned his ankle playing football, so he sat out that series. When England used to do the pre-test games of football, and he turned his ankle over doing that. Then he missed the Sri Lanka series because he was on paternity leave, so saw his firstborn arrive, a little girl. And is now back for the India series, which starts next week. So he hasn't played for a while, obviously, for one thing and another, and it'll be interesting to see how he does. Obviously, it's a huge test of his abilities when they play in India. That test match starts next Friday against very unusual subcontinental conditions for him, especially coming straight in, having not played in Sri Lanka. So we saw how well the others did, people like Joe Root, who got all those big runs. Well, Rory Burns will be coming back in, and it'll be you can forget about the nappies for a while, and we'll have to concentrate on the deliveries of a different kind. So we'll see how he goes.
What a beautiful you did that so well, Matt. So well, deliveries of a different kind. You've done this before. That is the ever eloquent Matt Gatchett, who is Deputy Sports Editor of the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us, Matt. If you want to get in touch, you can follow us at Mail Plus and me at Tory Boy Pierce. And finally, we've got some very good news. Are you fans of The Great Celebrity Bake Off? Because it's coming back to our screens. It's a charity special for Stand Up To Cancer. What's more, it's truly a proper stellar lineup. It includes the brilliant actor James McAvoy, the double Olympic gold medalist Dame Kelly Holmes, TV presenters like Annika Rice, remember her? I do, I'm old enough. Dizzy Rascal and Radio 1 DJ Nick Grimshaw. And of course, reporting it will be our very own Daily Mail reporter, Eleanor Sharples. Eleanor, that really is a proper good lineup.
Oh, it's fantastic. I definitely think probably one of the best that they have had, and plenty of names for people that people will recognise and and like to see do something a bit different than what they usually do.
I mean, James McAvoy is a very, very serious Hollywood A-lister these days, you would say, wouldn't you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, he's a fantastic one. To have him on board is brilliant.
How did they twist his arm? Has he got some particular interest in raising money for cancer? Do we know yet? I suppose all these human interest stories will be leaked nearer the time.
Yeah, so not 100% sure on whether he's actually a good baker and things, but from what he tweeted about the show when he was announcing the lineup, he said how much of a fan he's been for years and he's watched most of the seasons. And said that for him, it's a great honour to be baking for such a great cause. So, I think he'll be definitely one to watch.
Yeah, and Eleanor, explain, will it be just one programme, or will there be a number of them?
Yeah, so there's supposed to be 5 new episodes. So I'm guessing, I think there's 20 of them altogether. So they'll be spread out across the 5 episodes. And then each episode will see them do the typical challenges that the usual amateur bakers do, which is the signature, the technical and the showstopper. And then there'll be someone that will be awarded Star Baker at the end. So it will look very familiar to people, definitely.
Right. Now, remind us, there's 2 bake-offs, of course. This is the Great Celebrity Bake-Off. Which channel is this one on?
So this is on Channel 4.
And who are the judges?
The judges are Pam Lee from Paul Hollywood, as usual, and Matt Lucas is hosting this one as well. But it's quite interesting because they announced it just ahead of the Junior Bake Off final, which is happening later today at 5 o'clock on Channel 4 as well. So we've done a story for that in tomorrow's paper. It's brilliant. It's really, really taken off, and it's done very well for Channel 4 as well since the main bake-off moved to Channel 4 in 2017 from BBC One.
Because a lot of us thought that would be the end of it, you know, once they'd lost Mary Berry and they'd lost their anchor spot on the BBC. But actually, it's gone from strength to strength, hasn't it?
It really has. I think it's been an absolute winner for Channel 4. It hasn't seen the same level of viewing figures as the BBC did. But I mean, as we all know, the way TV is going at the moment, a lot of people can watch it in their own time. People like to binge watch things. So, you know, it is being watched very differently now. But yeah, definitely one to watch. And it's coming out in the spring.
Good. And so I've got a confession to make, Eleanor. I've still not watched it, but I will watch it this time because I am such a fan of James McAvoy. So when are we going to see it on air?
Yeah, all they're saying at the moment is in the spring. So hopefully we'd like to think we might be seeing it maybe April, May time. Fingers crossed. That's the plan at the moment.
And let's hope that horrible pandemic is at bay by then, so they can actually interact with each other.
Yeah, 100%. No, it'd be great.
All right, that's Eleanor Sharples, Daily Mail's TV showbiz reporter, with the latest on the Great British Bake Off. And that really is, for once, a stellar star lineup. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to all of our podcasts free and in full. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show. I'll be back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend and good night.